Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, I'm sensing more urgency around the country as more states begin to finalize plans for how they'll be approaching the coming full implementation of Affordable Care Act. It's not that many months away.
It's not. We've been saying that for a long time, but it's really here. And each state seems to be personalizing its own approach to the law, Mark. Florida, for example, was just given approval by the Obama administration to revamp Medicaid in that state by moving Medicaid into HMOs or other types of private managed care plans.
Well, we've been keeping an eye on Governor Rick Scott and the conservatives in that state who were seeking to save on health care costs while overhauling the Medicaid program in Florida.
And the proponents of Florida's Medicaid waiver say it will help the state control costs by better coordinating care. But critics of the Medicaid waiver are concerned it might negatively impact families who will need help the most by perhaps limiting choices and how they'll be able to access care.
Meanwhile, in Arizona, where there's been quite a bit of contention and pushback over the healthcare law, the conservative legislature did manage to pass the governor's request to expand Medicaid in the state. It's going to mean some 300,000 residents will gain access to healthcare through Medicaid expansion.
Well, as we've been saying, pragmatism might trump politics on this one. And the state of Michigan is also poised to vote for expansion of Medicaid. So I think that makes 29 states and the District of Columbia that have voted in favor of the Medicaid expansion. So it would seem, I don't know if I say this is one of the more popular aspects of the healthcare law, but it does seem to be a practical benefit, and it's leading millions more Americans to getting access to healthcare.
It's good news for patients gaining access, but also for teaching hospitals and safety net hospitals who stand a better chance of being compensated for providing care and conducting ongoing research.
And Mark, conversely, the online insurance exchanges don't seem to be enjoying that same level of support and expansion. A majority of the states have opted out of setting up their own state-based online insurance marketplaces. So it's going to look quite different for customers depending on which state you live in.
In Maine, customers are only going to have two plans to choose from compared to California, which will offer 13 plan choices to consumers seeking to purchase insurance through their exchange. Still, many unanswered questions about how the exchanges are going to work for many across the country.
But one thing is certain, for these exchanges to work as they're expected to, it's imperative that the federal government entice young uninsured Americans, healthy uninsured Americans, to purchase insurance through the online marketplaces. The broader the pool of healthy young adults in the exchange, the lower the rates expected to be for everyone. And the federal government is rolling out a campaign that is going to be very interesting. I think it's going to be aimed specifically at that demographic.
Our guest today was there in the inner circle when the Affordable Care Act was being crafted and has some views about how it will play out over the next coming decade.
Dr. Zeke Emanuel is a bioethicist and public health expert and will share his views on how the law is going to impact public health moving forward.
We've got another visit from Laurie Robertson, managing editor of factcheck.org. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And as always, if you have comments, email us at chcradio.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love to hear from you.
We'll get to our interview with Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. They're off and running. Former key players in the Department of Health and Human Services are now on the hunt for new gigs. Former acting CMS Administrator Dr. Don Berwick, key architect of the Massachusetts healthcare law, as well as the Affordable Care Act, is now officially on the run for governor of his home state of Massachusetts. Berwick is seeking to fill the seat being left vacant by Governor Deval Patrick, whose second term will draw to a close. Berwick is continuing to promote the advancement of health reform. Meanwhile, Anish Chopra, former chief technology officer for the White House, is now seeking a place in the Virginia State House. He is one of two candidates in the race for lieutenant governor in Virginia. Chopra led the government charge towards advancing health IT in this country. Chopra is the former Virginia chief of technology. And forget about Mozart making babies smarter. Brain imaging scans show that, in fact, breastfeeding does a fine job of that. Researchers using magnetic resonance imaging have added to the evidence that breastfeeding leads to increased rates of brain development. The study found that compared with babies who received formula, breastfed infants had increased development in white matter regions of the brain, including areas associated with planning, social and emotional functioning, motor ability, and language. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, bioethicist and fellow at the Hastings Center for Bioethics. He's vice provost for global initiatives and chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Emanuel served from 2009 to 2011 as special advisor for health policy to the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget. He is the author of over 200 peer-reviewed articles in 9 books and is currently a health columnist for the New York Times. Dr. Emanuel, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks for having me.
Zeke, you were in the inner circle, a special advisor at the Obama White House when the Affordable Care Act was being crafted and then passed.
Must be a very big inner circle.
Yes. And your brother, Ron, was chief of staff at that time. But many presidents before President Obama have tried and failed to win approval for meaningful health reform. So there obviously are many critics of the bill from the beginning up through today. But now we've had some time to analyze the aspects of the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Can you take a look back for our listeners about the challenges and successes, and how does it stack up against sort of the ideal vision of sweeping health reform that was sort of embedded in the White House and your colleagues when you initially worked on this legislation?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to emphasize that the healthcare system is so complex that it's hard to talk about an ideal. There are always trade-offs. You're always compromising. I think in general, the bill has done very well in certain areas. For example, I think it's really concentrated the attention of the healthcare system on improving quality, thinking about costs, and how to be much more efficient. And I think those are two very, very important things that would not, truth be told, they might have given lip service to, but I think because the Affordable Care Act is going into place, because there are penalties, for example, on hospital-acquired infections, medication errors, readmissions, they've really focused the attention of people and I think gotten serious reforms being implemented. Similarly, I think we're going to have exchanges. We're going to have a framework for everyone to get health insurance. I think that also is going to be a good thing. Probably out of the box, there are going to be some hiccups, some bumps in the road, but we need to take a long view of this, as your introduction made clear. We've been trying to reform the healthcare system, get universal coverage for 100 years. We finally have it. It's a huge part of our economy, 18% of the economy, one out of every $6. You can't expect to make major reforms overnight or even in a few years. This is the kind of thing that will take a decade to really filter through. You know, you need to keep your eye on 2020. That's when we're really going to be able to assess the bill.
So, Zeke, in your book, Healthcare Guaranteed, you noted that there's inefficiencies and inequities in the employer-based health insurance programs and that Medicaid, I think you've said, is a second-class system. So I guess the question is, what's the answer? Maybe there's two questions. In the book, you recommend another approach to universal coverage, one that would offer a more egalitarian solution, which I'd like you to tell us about. And I guess the second question is, do you see hope or signs of progress that both employer-based insurance and Medicaid are beginning to transform themselves from within?
Well, you know, again, Medicaid, we talk about it as if it were one system, but we need to be clear. There are really, in one way of looking at it, two or three broad classes of people who are in the Medicaid system. There are sort of children, pregnant women, mothers of young children. They are, by numbers, the largest group in Medicaid, a majority of people in Medicaid. But by cost and expense, actually a very small fraction of Medicaid. On the other hand, there are disabled people as well as elderly people, people who are so-called dual eligibles. They're a small minority of the people on Medicaid, about 20%, but they actually consume most of the dollars because they have chronic illness, whether physical illness or mental illness. They're in nursing home care. Those are going to require two different approaches. The second part, about 50% of Americans get coverage through the employer-based system. That is, their workplace negotiates and gets insurance options, and then they choose them. There are lots of reasons that that's not an optimal system. It creates job lock. It decreases wages. It creates this false sense by workers that they're not really paying for the health care. Their employer's paying, which is untrue. It's, as most economists have shown, coming out of their wages. Most economists, whether of the left or the right, think an employer-based system is not an ideal system, and we should move off it. Now, it's a little early to tell, but I think if the exchanges work as we anticipate and people are happy with the choices, people like shopping there, I think we may see a big shift over time. Again, nothing radical in a few years, but by more and more employers saying, look, my workers like it. It increases their job mobility. I can increase their wages. They can shop in the exchange to get their own health insurance. I think we may see more workers in the exchange, which would be good for the exchange in terms of having a diversity of people with diverse health conditions in the exchange. And I think it would free up the labor markets.
You know, I want to pull the thread a little on your thought of keeping prices down. And leading up to the passage of healthcare law, you wrote about the sort of overutilization in healthcare and sort of called it the perfect storm of overutilization. Blamed a lot of folks, you know, fee-for-service model, the docs, the patients, many of whom are looking for costly interventions that aren't evidence-based. So as we enter this new era with a whole new set of terms for the public to understand, accountable care organizations, patient-centered medical homes, how effective do you think the law is going to be, and or are we where Massachusetts was, that really its phase one was all about access, and now they're starting to get to phase two, which is really thinking about cost control prices?
First of all, unlike Massachusetts, the Affordable Care Act did have a large part of the bill that was focused on trying to both improve quality and reduce costs. But in the Affordable Care Act, we thought that they had to go hand in hand. And so the critics who say this is 90% access and we don't really focus on costs or quality, simply wrong. They haven't looked at the bill. They simply haven't taken into account many, many provisions in the bill, like the accountable care organizations, like these penalties for making mistakes, which will both keep costs down and improve quality. In addition, creating the exchanges, as we've seen in recently in Oregon, in California, the exchanges do look like they're having a downward price pressure on premiums, which is going to cascade through the system and have hospitals look at how they're operating, have physicians look at how they're operating to become more efficient. I think that kind of serious look at overutilization of services is going to happen across the board, and you're going to see, I think, a big impact on either improving quality, certainly maintaining quality, and being able to be more efficient about it. And I could give you example after example. Reducing the number of C-sections, increasing the number of normal vaginal births. That's going to be an important way of saving money. I was just talking to an oncology colleague of mine. I'm an oncologist, and he was saying, you know, we come in every Monday morning, and there are like 10 of our patients who had been admitted to the hospitals. We look over that list, and, you know, only four of them really needed to be in the hospital. The other six were, you know, if we had managed them better, we could have kept them out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. But let's be serious. We don't get paid to manage them better. The hospital likes them in the hospital because they make money that way. You change the incentives, we could certainly work more effectively to keep them out of the hospital. I think that's the kind of shift that we're in the process of making, and we're going to see a lot more of over the next few years.
Well, Zeke, in the Annals of Internal Medicine, you wrote about the need for a transparency imperative, and you cited Stephen Brill's recent, really kind of groundbreaking report in Time magazine, which was titled Bitter Pill, which exposed the total lack of transparency in healthcare pricing. You've said that to meaningfully control costs and to improve quality in healthcare, we've got to have transparency, and we need it in areas beyond pricing. So tell us about those other areas. Right. Where else do we need transparency in healthcare?
So I do think this Steve Brill's article has been a sort of watershed, not because it told the experts anything. I mean, all of us who are in the field knew this already and knew, you know, the fact that there are six different rates charged for the same thing and they make no sense. But for the public, it turned out to be an important watershed. And then it was quickly followed up. I think one of the reasons it's been so important, it was quickly followed up with the Medicare release of the charges that it sees from people so that there's actual data and people can begin to see systematically how problematic this is. But the transparency imperative is a very simple principle, which is we ought to have this information on pricing out there. We ought to have information on quality, and I'll say in a second why I think both are necessary. The bias of the system, as it were, has to be towards releasing pricing information, releasing quality information. Now, I'm not so starry-eyed as to say, oh, then, you know, the public's going to look and see the most efficient place to go. I actually don't think it's going to be largely the public that's going to drive it. I think it's actually going to be the healthcare system that's going to use that information most effectively. Because remember, if you're a doctor or you're now a hospital and you're paid a capitated rate, you're going to want to know who's the most efficient person I can refer a patient to who gives high quality care at a reasonable price. And that's where the issue is going to be. Because after all, when I go and get a colonoscopy, right, what do I know, right? You typically rely on my doctor. But if my doctor is somehow needs to pay for that referral, he's going to want to know that send me to a high-quality person. And frankly, right now, the doctor has no idea what things cost and who's got high quality. So I think the transparency imperative is going to be very helpful to the health system itself. Now, just having information on price is not very useful in and of itself, because you don't know if a low price is good quality or bad quality. So we need to have both the pricing and the quality data, and I think one without the other is really not that helpful.
We're speaking today with Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, bioethicist and vice provost for global initiatives and chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Emanuel served from 2009 to 2011 as special advisor for health policy to the director of the White House Office of Management and Budget. Zeke, let's talk a little more about data and big data. There are initiatives underway at HHS like Data Palooza to improve data sharing. Yet there remains considerable pushback within the healthcare arena when it comes to how we share the data. How do you see these opposing forces being reconciled in the emerging world of health data?
You can't improve unless you know what the data show.
That's true.
And you need a lot of people, especially since even quote-unquote common diseases like breast cancer aren't that common. And so you need lots of people in the system to find small but important differences and ways of managing patients. So I think it'll be good for the system. The big issue, I think, is getting the data in one place or aggregating data. It doesn't have to be in one place. That's my mistake. It, you know, can be distributed where it's being used, but we have to be able to connect the data. And that's, I think, so far been the big challenge. One of the reasons we have a lot of research on the Medicare database is once people are 65, they stay in the system. You can track them over time. We need to be able to do that for under 65-year-olds to be able to make some progress on these other areas. And there have been a lot of barriers in each insurance company wanting to preserve its own data, not willing to share, privacy concerns, all of which are legitimate, but I do think can be worked out. But I think in the long term, there's just no doubt that big data is, A, going to be important, and furthermore, we'll have a lot more of it with the electronic health records. It has been the case that the healthcare system have been Luddites about this. They've been very slow to adopt electronics, and I do think that's a serious problem. I'll just say, yesterday I had an experience. I got a blood test at my home institution, University of Pennsylvania, and I was getting a procedure at another institution, and they said, well, we can't find the blood test.
Oh, no.
And we were faxing the blood test. Okay, faxing the blood test. Well, if you're concerned about privacy, that's certainly not a good thing to do. And second of all, it does show you that we're still not at internet communication, which we certainly desperately need to be. I think, by the end of the decade, I'm pretty confident we will have overcome those problems. Once we actually have electronic health records, we'll not only be able to search what gets paid for, but we'll be able to search other concerns and issues that arise in the care of patients.
So Zeke, I'd like to take a closer look at an area that you've obviously thought deeply and written extensively about, and that's end-of-life care, where it's often said that most of a person's lifetime of health care dollars get spent.
False.
Okay, you can correct my statement there. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, this is a common thing. I go around speaking. People say, oh, well, 80% of all your spending gets done in the last 6 months or the last 12 months of life. That's an urban myth to the extreme. In Medicare, about 27 to 30% of all the expenses are for the 5 or 6% of people who die in the last year of life. But in the healthcare system writ large, and for most of us, it's around 10% of healthcare spending is in the last 6 or 12 months of life. That's still a lot of money, but it's not anywhere near most of the money we spend in our lifetime or 30% of it. So just getting the numbers right is a very important thing. The second point I'd like to make is just because we spend a lot doesn't mean we can save a lot. And so far, we don't have a consistent intervention that's been proven to save money at the end of life while improving the quality of care of dying patients. We have not invested in that research. I think it's very important to invest in that research. You know, I don't think any expert can reliably say we implement the following set of interventions, we're going to definitely save money, or we're definitely going to improve care. The proof in terms of what we would standardly call a randomized controlled trial, we haven't done it right.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, bioethicist, former health advisor to the Obama White House, and vice provost for global initiatives, and chair of the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. You can find out more about his writings and his work by going to EzekielEmanuel.com. Zeke, thanks so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Well, Mark and Margaret, this week we'll look at who's exempt from the individual mandate that's part of the Affordable Care Act. This is the requirement that, starting in 2014, people have to have health insurance or pay a fine. So who's exempt from this? Well, it's mainly low-income individuals, such as those who earn too little to be required to file tax returns. For 2012, that was those earning under $9,750 a year. Also exempt are employees who can't afford their work-based insurance and those who can't get an affordable offer of coverage on the insurance exchanges. There are also exemptions for hardships in obtaining coverage, and those are determined by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. The law also exempts those who have gaps in coverage of less than 3 months, members of Indian tribes, members of a health care sharing ministry, and members of certain religious groups that are already exempt from Social Security taxes. A few readers have asked us about Americans who are living overseas. Those who live abroad for a full calendar year are exempt, but those who live in another country temporarily are not. Also, residents of U.S. territories do not have to comply with the mandate. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Sitting down, it seems, can be as potentially deadly as smoking if done for long periods of time and over a long period of time, and that's not good news because we are a nation of sedentary sitters. And it turns out, sitting is a big contributor to our obesity epidemic. So when Steve Bordley was injured in an accident a few years ago, the active former elite athlete ended up sitting in a wheelchair for almost 2 years, and during that time, he gained a lot of weight. And when he had to learn to walk again, this former distance runner began to see the health benefits of just walking, not intensely, but consistently throughout the day. Now, the Surgeon General recommends 10,000 steps a day to maintain good health.
The University of Tennessee about 2 years ago did a study and found that the average American walks less than half of that amount. Now keep in mind, that's the minimum to maintain health. So we're actually deteriorating if we're walking less than that.
And when he was able to go back to work, he worried he was going to slide back into the pitfalls of sitting. His solution? He created the Trek Desk. Bordley designed a modular standing desk that fits over any exercise machine. The idea being, if you just walk slowly but consistently, the effects would be tremendous.
I was literally walking 10 hours a day, very slowly. And within a period of about 6 weeks, I lost more than 25 pounds. My back problems went away. And I was sleeping like I did when I was in my 20s.
And some research to date bears him out. Walking slowly throughout the day does seem to do remarkable things for your health. Reduce your chances of getting type 2 diabetes, reduce the risk of certain cancers, and maybe even reduce the incidence of first heart attacks.
People should at least move throughout the day. Whatever they can do to move is critical to their health. And that's really the message that we're trying to get out. Everybody should know the amount of steps they're taking during the day.
The Trek Desk, a simple reconfiguration of the typical workspace, but one that allows for purposeful movement throughout the day, improving health and well-being and cognitive skills. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.